Support for the Ohio Linux Fest has been provided by Zareason, a supplier of desktops, laptops, netbooks, and servers, all running Linux. Visit their website at zareason.com.
And a couple of notes before we begin. The first one is, if you feel at any point that you want to zone out and think of something else related to open source and education during my talk, please do so, because this is not so much about the stuff I'm saying, but the insights you have while you're sitting there. However, if you come up with something staggeringly brilliant that I totally should have mentioned or didn't know about or got completely wrong, I'm going to leave a lot of time at the end for questions and comments, so please pop up and tell me what I missed. So, a little bit of background on who I am. I am an engineer by trade. I used to make computers, talk to other computers, and now I work with open source communities and having them interface with universities, primarily with students and professors that want to get involved in open source projects. And I started out my career as an engineer for the One Laptop for Child project, and now I'm on the board of Sugar Labs, which makes the software for that. I work in a Fedora project, primarily with the marketing team, and I'm part of Red Hat community leadership team. And as part of that, we work with the teaching open source community, which is that group of professors interested in getting their students to participate in open source communities. And one of the things we do for them is run a week-long boot camp called the Professors Open Source Summer Experience, or PASSE, which gives them sort of a jumpstart emotion into the world of open source. So that's a bit of what I do. And today we're going to talk about failures. And we are not going to talk about what open source is, because I'm assuming if you're OLF, you already sort of know that there's open source and it's awesome, and if it wasn't too good, it would be even more awesome. I'm assuming that we're kind of on the same page as that, because you're here listening to this talk. And we're not going to be talking about getting schools and students to use open source more as consumers. We're primarily interested in figuring out how to get them to become members of the actual community, which means we need to find ways to build the academic community and the open source community. And so the way I'm going to do that today is by talking about all of the mistakes I've made while trying to figure out how to do exactly that, so that we can avoid these mistakes in the future. So, this is in a top 10 format. So there are 10 photos I'm going to tell you about. And first one, it's a very basic overview, it's assuming privilege. So I started out my career working with the One Laptop for Child project. I was a college student when I started volunteering. And so naturally, one of the first things I thought of doing was, well, why don't I get other college students involved too? Because my friends would like to work on this, and I'm sure other people like and want to work on this. And one of the things that we found out is that, especially because One Laptop for Child was an education project, not just a laptop project, a lot of people that had never contributed to open source before came in. They weren't necessarily interested in computers for the sake of computers. They were interested in using these things as a tool to meet kids in the developing world, all that good stuff. And they didn't necessarily have the sort of hacker mentality we sometimes assume. They thought they'd hit something and they'd go, oh my gosh, it's hard. I must be broken. I'm not good enough to help with this. I'm going to go away. As well as what we would tend to tell people is, if it's hard, there's something to be fixed, and you're exactly the right person to fix it because you found that bug. And so that's the more general topic, but it's something to keep in mind when you're working with students, because these are people who have not yet gotten themselves self-started into open source communities, and they may not know about the culture that we share. So, as I was going through working with other university students in One Laptop for Child, one of the things that they kept coming up to me and saying, yes, I'm interested in working on this, and then doing absolutely nothing. And after a couple months of this, and multiple students, multiple universities, obviously very bright, motivated, interested, successful people, but so what's stopping you? I said, well, we're not really quite sure what to do. We can't figure out how to get together, how to ask for resources, and our teachers don't know what to make of this, and the school doesn't either. And so finally what happened is we decided, all right, if you're a university student and you're interested in working with ORPC, start a club on campus. Because what that did, that immediately clicked the man, students know how to start clubs. Universities know how to interface with clubs. You can get funding, you can get rental room space, teachers know how to deal with clubs. So they got that sort of interface, and they were off and running. They started having hackathons, doing class projects, inviting speakers to campus. So if you give people something they're used to saying yes to, they will say yes. And so these university chapters kind of went along, and they were doing very well. But they always seemed very anxious, very nervous. And so I went up to a couple of the more active chapters, and I said, well, what's the problem? I said, well, we're not sure if we're doing things correctly. I said, no, well, you're not doing anything wrong. You're not making any mistakes whatsoever. And I kept on trying to say these things and thought that they were reassuring. But actually, what they wanted to hear was not that they weren't making any mistakes. We're used to hearing that we have the right answer, not that we don't have the wrong one. And in school, when you're used to looking for the right answer that someone's thinking of, you don't necessarily realize that the absence of a wrong answer in the open source world means that you do have the right one. So, switching gears a little bit. So, university chapters went on for a little while, and then I went over to Red Hat and I started working with individual schools. One of the schools that I was working with is Allegheny College, and there were some people in the room who may recall this story, although I will not use names to make sure that I'm the only one that looks at a study up here. They were bringing 40 first year students, nine majors, most of them would never be computer science majors, into participating in the marketing group of Fedora. And so they were writing feature profiles, interviewing people, making websites. And so one day, one of the students shows up on IRC and said that in blue, I want to learn how to use Git. As version control system was a completely new concept to them. Didn't even know what version control was, just had heard the word Git, decided it was something she should learn, and that she wanted to find out about it. And so a couple of Fedora community members very, very helpfully jumped in and gave this exhaustive explanation of what version control was and sort of walked me through it. And I thought this was really helpful. And so I talked to the professor afterwards and said, isn't this awesome? These people are teaching their students about Git. But his reaction was, oh my gosh, why are they doing that? One of the things that is different about schools versus open source communities is that if you want to enter the open source world and you know what you want to do, people are going to help you do it, whether or not it's a good idea. But when you're in school, one of the things that teachers do is make sure that the thing you want to do is actually a good idea to do. So it turns out in the case of this student, learning Git was absolutely useless to her, and that what we should have done was actually teach her HTML, because that's what she needed to edit the web page. And students trust that you're going to be steering them, not just that they won't stumble on a path, but that they're going to be going down the right one. So that's something to keep in mind. And another thing we found out, we were working in this group of 40 students in Allegheny, started talking about, so in the open source world, new volunteers come in, new volunteers go out. Some of them stick around, some of them drift away, and we're okay with that. You know, if we get like 10% of the new people that show up, stick around, we think that's fantastic and we're doing a great job. But in the equivalent here, if that was the way it worked with this class, then 4 students out of 40 would actually pass and 36 would fail. And that's a problem. And so, understanding that teachers had to deal with those 36 students, we could go really far with the 4 that were doing fantastic, but you had to spend a lot of time bringing everybody else up to speed, was an important difference. And once we started realizing that that was important, if we wanted that class to participate, we needed to make it possible for everybody in the class to participate, not just the superstars, we started doing a lot better. So another of the schools that we work with in teaching open source community is RIT, the Rochester Institute of Technology. And they had a class to do development of activities for Sugar, the games and activities that run on the One Laptop Per Child project, and other computers now too. And one of the constant complaints was I would get emails and I would see chat pings from members of the civil community going, "Who are these people? They tell us to be online at certain times, but it's 3 a.m. in my time zone, I can't make that." And then they're never online any other time. And then students were also coming up and saying things like, "You know, I couldn't find the answer to this question. I'm sorry, I didn't get this thing done." And so Carly Robinson, one of the local hackers in Rochester, who's also an active in the Door Project, was talking with a student one night and said, "I was up late last night and I was thinking about, you know, doing this, but I couldn't figure out the answer to my question." She said, "Well, did you go online and ask somebody?" She said, "Oh no, I couldn't do that, it was midnight." Like, well, honey, you're in the open source world now. We have people in all time zones, and if it's midnight here, it's noon in China. And there's somebody awake in France that can help you out. And just go and check that out." And so the idea of not being constrained to class time and the idea of having open office hours is not something that we thought in advance to explain to the students because we thought it would be obvious, but getting them to start thinking, "Oh, these people are accessible. We don't have to walk to the professor's office at a certain time. We can tap these resources whenever we want." That was a key, crucial part that we were missing. Also from the same school, after this class, some of the students got so interested that they decided to continue as co-op. So this basically became the unpaid full-time job for 10 weeks to continue working the project that they started in class. And then we got more complaints from the open source community saying, "Where are these students? They announce their work, we can't find it, it comes out of nowhere, they never talk to us, and they just dump large wads of code on us and think that it's fantastic. What's happened?" And so I went back to Rochester, I sat down with students, and I said, "Hey, so you're supposed to be learning how to work and collaborate with the open source community this quarter, right?" He said, "Oh, yes, we're totally doing that." I said, "Well, okay. How are you collaborating on open source code? Please show me." He said, "Well, okay, so we put the GPL on everything, and so it's open source. And every day when we sit down to work, I sit down next to him and he sits down next to me and I email him my code. And we look at each other's laptops and so we're collaborating with each other." "Yeah, that's good, but would you like other people helping you code also?" "Like, oh yes, we would love that." "How come they're not doing that?" "Where would they find your code? How can they download it? Have you talked to them and told them you exist?" So we really quickly taught them about, you know, code repositories and announcing things from Yahoo. But this is something that's important to dwell in people's minds. If it's not public, it didn't happen. If it didn't cross the mailing list, if you had the best conversation in class ever, if you don't push it out to the community, it's almost like it doesn't come. And making that explicit to the professor as a means of grading them, so, you know, professors have done things like say, "I'm going to grade you based on your wiki page. Not on the code you hand in to me at the end of a semester, but what's in the Git repository. What's been commented on and the bugs you're working on." And making sure that they're evaluated on the stuff that's public, not just the stuff that's made, so they'll make the stuff public as important. So, also in the RIT co-op, they asked me to become an evaluator for them, and at the end of the term, they come in and give them grades and all that stuff. And grades being sort of, in a way, necessarily evil, because they need some way to tell what students pass and fail. All of them passed, by the way. They were great. So, not knowing where you're going at the end of term is very, very disconcerting, both to students, which is something they have to get used to because you're going to start defining your own problems and your own project as you get further along the road, but also to the professors, because they need some way to make these things fit into the ordered system of the university. And so one concept that was very helpful to get across, and this is pedagogical speak, is the notion of summative and formative assessment. Now, formative assessment is the kind of feedback that we get in the open source world every day. It's people commenting on your patches, it's people replying to your emails, or not replying to your emails because you've written something nobody cares about. lack of feedback is feedback. It's stuff that's designed to help you sort of guide and shape yourself into doing what you want to do better. But what scores need also, in addition to that at the end, is summative assessment, something that at the very end says, here's how you did, here's exactly how well you did, and why. And so this is actually a benefit of working in an open source community. They thought it was going to be harder to grade, but it's actually easier to grade, because what you can do is all that formative assessment is stuff that's publicly documented online. So you can look at people's Git commits, you can look at their code reviews, you can look at their mailing list posts, and so you can gather all that formative assessment and use it at the end for a much more comprehensive summative assessment. Professors like that. And so in addition to working with scores, I also work with individual students that are interested in working with open source projects and have somehow found a way to convince some teacher that they should get the credit. And so there was a high school senior in Arlington who worked on Sugar at the very end of the senior year, right before he graduated. And sometimes I run into this problem that these students, when you say, yes, I will mentor you to the open source stuff, think that you know everything. This is a problem, because you don't. And so it becomes a bottleneck. I mean, it's really nice to have somebody look up to you and think you know things, but you don't actually know as much as they think you do. You can't convince them of that. And then you become a bottleneck for them. They sit around for 2 days because you've gone to New York with your cousins and don't realize that they've been stuck on one line of code for the past 48 hours. And because they think you know everything, they're just waiting for you to come back and tell them the almighty answer, when in fact you wouldn't have a clue if you look at that either. And so you need to constantly tell these people that you need to look beyond you. What I'm here for is not necessarily to convey information to you, I don't have the answers, but to teach you kind of search strategies you need to find the answers on your own from lots of other resources and lots of other people. And so for this high school student, what actually finally made it click is that he got stuck on his Python bug that involved a section of the stack that I had never touched before, had no clue about. And he asked me, and he kept on asking, what do I do? And so I finally said, look, I don't know what to do. I've looked at this, I've crawled through the code, I can't figure it out myself, but what I'm going to do, instead of opening up Python, trying to hack around and getting lost, what we're going to do is we're going to sit down together and we're going to write an email to the mailing list asking for help. So I will help you write an email, and then you will send the email, and then I'm going to go to lunch. So I sent the email, I went to go and get some sushi, and when I came back about half an hour later, he'd gotten 2 replies from the mailing list, one from the author of the module, one from the maintainer of the module, and they had stopped his problem. And he went, oh. And from that day on, I was no longer a bottleneck to him when he actually started opening up to the rest of the community and showing his work with his grades. And so the last and biggest thing I wanted to talk about in terms of FAIR, and this is just like the first one, more general FAIR. There are two entirely different worlds here. There's the education world and the open source world. And from trying to talk with people in both worlds a number of years, the difference, as we've summarized it, mostly goes like this. If you go to any random university and you talk with students there and you say, well, what are you doing when you graduate? A lot of people are going to say, ah, I don't know. And that's okay. It's okay to not know where you're going when you graduate. But they also know that they're going to be there for 2 years or 4 years or however long it is. They know that what their course requirements are. They know they're probably going to have to take this stuff their sophomore year, and that they've got to pass this class, which is a prerequisite for the next one. So they don't know where they're going, but they know how they're going to get there. And in the open source world, if you walk into a room of people and say, well, what are you working on? And they say, oh, I don't know. That's probably a bad thing. We know where we're headed. We don't necessarily know how we're going to get there, how long it's going to take, what resources we're going to use along the way, who's going to come and help us. You know, we don't have a course together saying, and next semester I will take networking with Professor X. And so because of those two diametrically opposite extremes, it's really difficult to interface between those two worlds, because if a student wants to if they had an idea for an open source project, then they got to find a way to cram it into that nice linear academic schedule. And the project and the open source are going to be unpredictable, but the classes are not. And likewise, people in the open source world looking for help on their project need to find some way to make it fit within the timeline of schools, make it predictable so they can say, yeah, when we start the class at the beginning of the semester, we can grade them at the end of the semester, even if you're not quite sure exactly what you're going to make yet, but how far you're going to go. So seeing that kind of dichotomy would help people good to do, instead of assuming that people coming from the academic world will look at open source communities and go, it's so chaotic, how do you ever get anything done? It's just driving me crazy. You're not thinking about what you're doing, you're not thinking ahead. And people from the open source community will go to schools and go, oh my gosh, there's so many restrictions, so many constraints, how do we deal with it? We're stifled, we can't move. And so understanding the benefits and drawbacks of either side and figuring out how to pitch between them is really important. So, we talked a bit about failures, but one thing I wanted to point out through all these stories is that all these kinds of failures are debuggable. Once you start doing things like understanding that academia and open source have different release cycles, for instance, the release cycle for a student may be 4 years long, or maybe 6 months, and have different penalties. If our release cycle skips a week, it's more or less okay. If their release cycle skips a week, the student has to take another semester of classes before they graduate. So there's a little bit of a different risk assessment there. And also, making sure that people in both worlds talk and engage with each other on a day-to-day basis. So I was talking with a group of professors a couple months ago about getting involved with open source communities, and I said, well, how do you interface with local community groups and businesses and such already? Do you talk with them? And I said, oh yes, we have such great open communications with local industry. Every year, one day per year, we invite visitors, one person from every business that wants to work with us. They come and we feed them lunch and we take them on a tour of our lab, and then they sit down and they tell us what we need to fix in our curriculum. And this happens how often again? Oh, once a year. Every single year we do this. It's fantastic. Okay. And I thought about, my parents, when I was in college, my parents came and visited me once a year, and I took them on a tour of all my labs, and I told them about all my classes, and then they went home. They have no idea what I did in college. And so if we want to interface between the school community and our private communities on more than that kind of visit basis, we need to come up with a neutral space where people can hang out at a time. They don't feel the need to put on fancy slides, fancy suits. Just sort of hearing the day-to-day problems that people have, keeping in mind that we come from different contexts. There may already be people that do this in your community. You may know them as contributors to your open source project who are students or professors, or will be students or professors at some point in the future. Or if you come from the school context, there may be people, staff, faculty, sometimes the IT staff at school, who are involved in open source projects. So these are people that already live in both worlds. And they're the ones that already kind of, they may not realize they're doing it, but they're already bridging those two challenges, those two things. And if you look at them and say, how do you do that? How can you make what you're doing scale more? They'll be able to tell you how to adapt it to your particular project or your particular institution. And so one place for a lot of these people who are bridging is them both from the open source community side and from the academic side come and hang out and share their stories is the teachingopensource.org community. So we have grad students, we have professors, we have students who are doing this independently, we have people from open source communities that want to work more closely with universities. This is where we hang out, this is our neutral space where we don't have to put on fancy suits for each other, and we'd love to have more people join us. And that is all I had. I will now open the floor up for questions and whatnot. Nothing? Thoughts?
So how do you, when you're talking about like a release, when you're released, how does that coordinate, when you're coordinating with like groups like between like different universities? Mm-hmm. So like you work in one part of a release and you're saying, this part, how is that coordinated between all those, you know, type of people between that and the main developers who are trying to tie that together?
Okay, so the question was, how do you tie release cycles of open source projects to different schedules and calendars of different universities? Is that? In terms of how well that works, the answer is poorly. It is a problem. It's a huge problem because people go on winter break and middle of, you know, and release day is like a week after they leave. The way that usually gets buffered is it gets buffered on the academic side of things. So professors that say, we're going to have all our students work on Mozilla bugs during the semester, will say, we don't expect this community to change the schedule for one institution. We're going to look at the release calendar and look where we can fit ourselves. So maybe we'll start fixing bugs, make sure we finish them all before the beta or wrap them up, even if there's 3 weeks left in the semester because the final release milestone is in Thanksgiving. So that's usually up to the individual professor. So knowing that usually has to happen from that side is a useful thing to keep in mind. And from an open source community perspective, one thing to think about is keep that in mind when you're talking with the professors and say, all right, when did your term start, when is it end, when are you on break? Oh, by the way, did you know that this date in our release cycle may be slightly problematic for you? How would you like to deal with that ahead of time? So helping them anticipate that.
Yeah, is there like virtual communication, you know, between like developers and universities when Skyping or, you know, whatever, when it comes to, you know, when you talk about particular aspects, so, you know, so they get more in touch to, you know, what's going on?
Yeah. As a matter of fact, so, if there's communication between developers and universities, the most successful engagements we've had are the ones in which they didn't make a separate sandbox space for university work. The professor was contributed to the project and he said, you're going to contribute directly to this project. You will hang out in the same LRT channels and be a part of the same mailing list. When I talk with you and give you feedback on your work, I will, you know, put it on a reply to the mailing list you sent out to all the developers on the project. We're going to go in. It's like instead of having, say, a Chinese class in Ohio, you take your class out and you fly into Shanghai for 3 weeks and you walk around and go, that sign means duck, that sign means rice. and so having that mentality instead of having two separate camps you want to interface between helps a lot because then they're actually there and being actual developers instead of having to talk with them remotely. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay. Cool. Any other questions or stories?
I've got a question about the kinds of projects that lend themselves to this sort of thing. Like, is it just the smaller collections of bugs, like the entry, the simpler problems, not to qualitate them or anything, but the simpler stuff lend itself better to this, or can you get a team of students to work on a deeper, like a file system issue or something that's a little bit lower level than, you know, interface bugs on the browser or something? What have your experiences been with bigger, deeper projects like that this year?
Okay, so the question is on the scopes of problems and projects that are good for students, and whether you need to give everybody little bite-sized bugs, or whether you can get students more involved in deeper projects. And the answer is yes. And actually, we've had more success in bigger, deeper projects. They're a lot more fun. You know, you're part of this much larger, more impressive thing. There are more options for people with different skills and interests to go into. And students in classes, you know, they span this whole spectrum. So in the same class, you might get a couple of struggling students that need simpler things and more hand-holding. You might have a couple of brilliant folks that are just ready to go off and do this crazy feature people wanted for the past 5 years. And the most important criteria, I think, for an open source project, you know, so how do I make myself ready for a classroom? It's not so much the technology you need as it is the mentorship. So it's not that you need a minimum number of bugs or minimum level of bugs. I think the most important criteria is, at any given point in time, when these students need to find somebody to ask for help, can they find somebody to ask for help? And that's one of the reasons why larger, broader open source communities are easier to do this with, because there are more people, it's more likely someone's going to be awake in IRC or watching the mailing list. But if you are a single developer and you really, really want to do this, and you're like, I'll give everyone my cell phone number so you can call me at 3, well, maybe that might be a little bit extreme, but if you make yourself really available to them, making sure that there's going to be that kind of availability. Because we want people to not just contribute to open source code, we want them to join the community so they continue to contribute open source code after the development class. And so the important thing is not to get them, if you get them a really good, well-portioned bug and they go off by themselves and they solve it and they hand it back to you and then they go away, that's great. You know, they contributed something. But if you actually get them in a dialogue and they get to know people and they're like, oh wow, we didn't finish this release cycle, but next release cycle would be really cool and I could work with that person over there, or maybe this code could help mine and I could review her code, and then they're much more likely to stick around. So it's the community interface, not the code interface, that's more important.
What about, like, you're talking about a lot of this stuff, you're talking about this at the undergraduate level, or you're talking about, like high school, or you're talking about, like, because, like, a lot of these parts sound like they could go through, like graduate level versus undergraduate versus even high school, if people got programming and coding chops. So have you looked at like, the different levels between, like, those type of educational sections?
So the question was on working with different levels, high school, undergraduate. Generally speaking, if you're working with a classroom, individuals will pop up at any age. I think whenever they pop up, it's great to see if you can mentor them and guide them and everything. If you're working at the classroom level, and not everybody is necessarily there of their own free will,
I was just wondering, what is the underlying fundamental course that the university would be teaching that these people might be cooperating in? Because if you're trying to have a course in how to do collaborative development, then it really doesn't make any difference what the project is or how long the person participates in it. Because what they have to do is they have to go in, they have to see what the ongoing project is, they then have to evaluate where they can help out and interact with the already existing development community. If, however, it's a course in database design, then it might be more difficult for them to collaborate and join in an already existing project and get out in time with something that they can be graded on.
Yeah, and that's a great point. So I want to finish answering this question and touch on exactly that. Thank you, Amanda. So in terms of different levels, if you're working with an entire class, personally, it's easier to work at the college level and above, because K-12, most of them are under 18, there's all sorts of legal restrictions on what you can and can't do. But the university, the more independent, you don't have to babysit them anymore, they can be expected to actually be rich. So you've mostly done college level and up. And in response to what the class, there are two answers to that question. First, it is absolutely, in my opinion, ideal to have a collaborative development class. It's basically, how do you become part of your open source community? And actually, the workshop we teach for professors on how to do exactly that, the curriculum for that was originally based on exactly that class, Project Seneca College. And it's, for third year students usually, they've got basic programming and now they need to know how to do it with other people. And the way to do it is by pick an open source project to do something else. That having been said, it's really difficult to get a class like that started from ground zero. Professors usually have to propose classes 1 or 2 years in advance. They have to go through all sorts of approval processes, and then they have to figure out what classes are we going to draft so we can teach this one. So that's a little hard. So to gain ground, figuring out which classes can do a small, so like a database design class, figuring out 1 or 2 exercises and going, this is the most beneficial thing to our students all term. What if we had a class on it?
But I think that more and more universities have to understand that that type of course is absolutely critical these days, because what happens a lot of times is they generate students coming out of college who think, I'm going to work on a new project from ground zero, when in reality, they're going to have to be working with a team. And whether the team is local, whether the team is distributed, doesn't make any difference. It's a collaborative effort. you know, for the most part, starting off in the days of the single programmer sitting in a garage working on something, you know, it happens every once in a while, but it isn't what you normally get.
What I would absolutely love to see is, and more computer science programs and more engineering programs are starting to talk that way. It's good academic consensus and the education strategy. We need to teach our students teamwork and collaboration with distributed teams and large-scale projects. What I would like to do is start going to those places and talking to those people. Check out open source projects. You've been doing those for years. And have that be the answer. So I think Mikko, and then I think we might be out of time.
Okay, I said I just wanted to say that my school has a development open source class and it has a team project development class. The team project development class is a required course and the development open source one is an elective. That one's been getting more students each year, but I think that they could do more. I think that it should be part of the software engineering 2 course too, because you come out of software engineering 2 going, oh yeah, I always look at Christine code, and then we commented, because who comments code in the real world? Not enough people.
So thanks for bringing it up. One thing you can do is, instead of just hanging out in open source places, if you care about getting open source into education, go where the educators are. If you're a student or if you have some way of getting to a university, you can go to an academic conference, or you can go and visit a professor and talk on their turf about these things, or you can go and sit down with a student who may not necessarily have a professor who knows what open source is and say, well, all right, you need to do a project this term. Let me help you see how this would be so much more awesome if you did it with GNOME. And then that's the way to start getting things in there without explicitly needing permission from the institution. And that's the way to get them to, because they're not necessarily going to come to us. You have to have to go to them and show them you've got something to share. I think one last comment.
Quick question, might be a longer answer. Have you approached the aspect of getting students who aren't really CS students into areas like testing and into documentation and translation and maybe user interface design, getting the graphic students and that kind of thing?
I'm really glad you brought that up. Yes. We started with focusing on teachers of computer science, software engineering, mostly because they were the people that were already coming to us. But for instance, last summer at RIT, when we did that Poppy workshop, we had technical writing professors, journalism professors come in. One of our Poppy alumni is teaching a user interface design class and going, would any open source projects like help designing the interfaces, anybody? We find just one would be enough. And then a technical writing professor and a journalism professor came in and went, oh my gosh, you need people to interview developers? I've been looking for interview opportunities for my students for ages. And so, actually, if you can get them to think outside the bounds of coding, that's even more useful to them and in many ways to us. So, yeah, think outside that box, please. We're just starting to do that. We need a little bit more work there, but if you hang out and teach open source right now, that's what we're talking about. So, come join us. And maybe this reminded me that there's also a great website called openhatch.org, which is for other bite-sized bugs. You mentioned they try to navigate starter bugs for many different projects, and professors are sometimes pointed at that as a good resource for easy things for the students to fix. So I will be hanging around the conference if you want to talk more about this. Thank you very much for listening. Thank you.